From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. We've got a great program for you tonight. If you're listening to us on KFI AM 640 in Los Angeles, from 11 p.m. to 11:30 p.m. Pacific time, transmitter maintenance, switch to the iHeartRadio app on KFI AM 640, and you'll not miss a thing, and then switch back later on. Later tonight, a former cancer victim tells his incredible story. Here's what's happening. President Joe Biden made an impassioned appeal to Russian President Vladimir Putin today to step back from war with Ukraine, speaking of the needless death and destruction that Moscow would cause and international outrage that Putin would face. In a nationally televised speech, the president said the United States estimates that 150,000 Russian troops now encircle Ukraine, adding that while reports that some forces had already withdrawn, they were welcome, they were unverified, and the invasion remained very much a possibility, they say. Listen to this story. Remington Arms will pay $73 million to the families of five adults and four children killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre, marking the first time a gun maker has agreed to a major settlement over a mass shooting in the United States. 20 students, six adults, were killed on December 14, 2012, in Newtown, Connecticut, by gunman Adam Lanza, who used a Remington Bushmaster AR-15 rifle to shoot his way into the Sandy Hook Elementary School, killing his mother at home, and then he killed himself. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, with us here. John, I've got a couple questions here before we get your reaction and report on this. This being the first time a gunmaker has volunteered to do this kind of a settlement, my heart goes out deeply to the family members who lost their children in this tragedy and the other six who were there in the school, adults. But was the gunmaker culpable for this?
No, and the gun maker has not accepted culpability or liability. It's the insurance companies that represent the gun maker that are paying for this $73 million settlement. And as we've known for a long time, these movements to tamper with the Second Amendment haven't really paid many dividends. And it's great impassioned pleas. Nobody likes to see mass violence. But this Adam Lanza, when you look at this 20-year-old with Asperger's disease and a number of other mental problems, his mother basically holding a Bushmaster AR-15 in her house with 30 magazines, each with 30 rounds in it. It's and not only that, I mean, he had semi-automatic handguns also brought with him. But I mean, the outrage of, you know, the situation, everybody gets it. It's a public health issue that 47,000 people in 2021 have already died of violence, whether they are from handguns or AR-15s, it doesn't matter. But the real question that people have to ask themselves is that when you have families that are affording access to weapons to teenagers and others who are mentally ill, you have to ask yourself that this is this is the volatile situation that comes up that in many instances results in mass shootings and this kind of violence against schools, children, and families across the United States. So I think, it tragic as it is, George, and this the protection of by gun makers was signed into law, as you know, in 2006 by George W. Bush. And the bottom line is that the insurance in this particular case is paying for it because the company's bankrupt, and the company's been liquidated. So it's an insurance claim at this point, and I don't think it will carry over. And remember that the argument that was made in federal court was that the company was using marketing techniques that were designed to appeal. You know, it's kind of like cigarette smoking or vaping or something along those lines.
Inducement.
They were appealing to disturbed teenagers, and that's what the jury concluded. So I don't think this generalizes to any other case for any other gun maker. I think it was certainly a bankruptcy issue that was handled by the insurance industry.
And what about the other people who were killed, the other 16 children and the other adult? I mean, this only mentions five adults and four children sharing
As you know, the first one killed was his mother, who was shot between the eyes by this lunatic. And you're right. I mean, you know, there were only nine that participated in this kind of class action suit, you know, that resulted in this insurance settlement. But, I mean, you know, this is the kind of problem we have when the liability is so extreme in these cases. And the only thing that's really going to make a difference is not banning or not restricting necessarily these guns and compromising the Second Amendment. It's going to be holding adults accountable to teenage murders by creating laws that say that parents will be held accountable for giving access to those weapons to their teenagers.
Good point. Dr. John Curtis, his website, onlinecolumnist.com. The looming shutdown of 3G networks, not 4G, won't just impact older phones. Listen to the story. With AT&T's 3G network shutting down next week and other carriers following suit later this year, a range of products require updates to continue working, including some home alarm systems, medical devices such as fall detectors, and in-car crash notification and roadside assistance systems such as General Motors OnStar. So just keep your eyes on that story. A good night's sleep every night may be the best way to prevent the onset of Alzheimer's disease, according to a new study. Researchers from the Polytechnic Institute say a person's circadian rhythms play a key role in wiping out a protein that clumps up in the brain and eventually causes dementia. A Catholic priest in Phoenix has resigned from his position after a church investigation found that he had incorrectly performed baptisms over his 20-year career, rendering the rite invalid for thousands of people that he baptized. As he poured the holy water during the baptisms he performed, the Reverend Andres Arango would say, "We baptize you in the name of the Father, of the Son, and the Holy Spirit." But the Father misstated one word. "We baptize" should have been "I baptize." And getting that word wrong nullified all of the rituals that he performed using that language. What people believe happens after death guides how they think about the earth and how they behave, including whether they choose to recycle or buy energy-efficient appliances, according to a new study. Research from Arizona State University and the University of Wyoming has found that religious beliefs about the afterlife predicted how people value and practice sustainability. Let's check in with our expert on the afterlife, Sandra Samplain. Sandra, this is an amazing story, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And thank you for letting me share. The research done has really shown these people's beliefs dictate how we live now. For instance, George, people who believe in reincarnation, they care for the earth because they want a good place to come back to. And that makes sense. These people are recycling, they're keeping the environment clean, they're shopping locally, reducing their waste, they volunteer, they keep their electric bills low, and many have turned to vegetarian and vegan diets. And now the study shows that people that are Christians, Muslims, and Jews, they typically believe in some kind of judgment in the afterlife. And the ones studied seem to value more personal independence, personal success, especially financial independence. They may feel the more they achieve and accomplish in this life will be rewarded in the afterlife. And then we have those spiritual but not religious folks who have a yearning to find meaning and understanding of their lives. And they're constantly looking for answers about life's biggest questions. And they can be found exploring different beliefs, trying new things. They're open to friendships with different types of people. And they're always looking for a feeling of community. And then we've got the atheists and the agnostics. And while they may not believe or question if God exists, they may believe in the afterlife. So these folks, they seem to care for the environment, care for others and for animals, feeling that we may be all connected by some universal sort of energy. Now, despite the differences in the religious beliefs, this study found that participants had one thing in common. They felt an importance to reduce their demand on the Earth's natural resources while increasing the production of sharing their own unique talents and gifts. So, if you know your religious affiliation, see if the study description fits you. And if you don't know what you really truly believe in the afterlife, perhaps the way you are living life now will point you in the direction of what your heart truly believes. So thank you for letting me share, George.
Thank you, Sandra. Sandra's one of our podcasters on the Paranormal Podcast Network, Shades of the Afterlife, which you can hear, of course, on the iHeartRadio app. Just look for Coast to Coast AM and listen to the podcast, and you'll have some great times. Astronomy experts say they originally misread the secrets of the night sky last month. It turns out that a rocket expected to crash into the moon in early March was built by China, not SpaceX. The rocket is now said to be the booster for one of China's launched in 2014 as part of the Chinese Space Agency's Lunar Exploration Program. Up next, Amy Webb joins us. Her latest work is called The Genesis Machine. We are going to talk about synthetic biology. That's right, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, our guest Amy Webb with us, quantitative futurist, founder of the Future Today Institute, award-winning author of several books, The Big Nine and The Signals Are Talking and The Genesis Machine, which we're talking about tonight. She writes extensively about biotechnology, artificial intelligence, technology policy, business strategy, regularly contributing to publications including Harvard's Business Review, the New York Times, Wired, Fortune, Mother Jones, MIT Sloan Management Review, and others. Her latest book, The Genesis Machine, Our Quest to Rewrite Life in the Age of Synthetic Biology. Amy, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, George.
How did you get involved in this?
How did I get involved in synthetic biology or being a futurist?
Yeah, all of that.
All of it. I guess I can start with what I do for a living, because I know it's kind of a strange-sounding job. A futurist is somebody basically who anticipates disruption and opportunity, and it's as much a science as it is an art. My background is economics and game theory, academically, and I just research signals of change using statistics and deep research and sometimes creative thinking to methodically analyze next order outcomes. So that's what I do for a living. Most of my focus is on emerging technology and science. And over the years, obviously, artificial intelligence has been a pretty big topic of interest. But there's this interesting overlap between tech and biology. And as I was researching AI, I kept coming across this sort of new field called synthetic biology, which is a emerging area of science that involves redesigning organisms for useful purposes by engineering them to have new abilities. And that kind of takes us to right now.
Amy, we're going to call you on your other phone, your cell phone, so pick that up right now, would you? Because you're breaking up on the other one. So you do that. Pick that up for me, and we will get you back on in a little better connection if we can. You were breaking up just a little bit. So pick that up, and we will get going. We're talking with Amy Webb about the Genesis Machine, Our Quest to Rewrite Life in the Age of Synthetic Biology. And it is an incredible story of just how it's going to affect our lives and everything that we're going to do. So how are we doing there, Tom? We got her? Okay, there you go. A little better connection there, Amy.
All right, sounds good.
So anyways, what is exactly synthetic biology?
Sure. So here's all you really need to know. Synthetic biology is an emerging area of science that involves redesigning organisms for useful purposes by engineering them to have new abilities. It's a relatively new field that kind of combines engineering, design, and computer science with biology. And the techniques that are used require basically computer programming, but instead of programming computers, scientists are programming cells. And I think pretty soon, you may not have heard of synthetic biology yet, but pretty soon synthetic biology is going to be as commonly talked about as artificial intelligence is today.
Would you say this is good for humanity?
I think it absolutely is good for humanity, with the caveat that any new science or technology has the potential to be used for malicious purposes. I like to tell people that, you know, a fork can be a deadly weapon if you stab somebody in the neck with it. And that's true of every new science, every new technology. There's always a potential for somebody to misuse it.
Well, that's possible. And it gets into the wrong hands as well, right?
Right. But again, I think the majority of what we're seeing today is really scientists who are trying to solve some of our biggest existential crises using an alternative method, using biology.
Making synthetic blood, for example, is that what we're talking about here? Things like that?
Well, I don't know that synthetic blood would be top of mind. I think what we're talking about more so are, at the moment, alternatives to how we get pregnant, for example. There's something called genetic surgery, which, again, I know sounds kind of scary, but basically what it entails is taking embryos, and before they are implanted using IVF, in vitro fertilization, screening them to see if they've got any abnormalities, and then using some of these biotechnology techniques to sort of fix those embryos, fix the abnormalities before the embryos are implanted. So that's one example. There are researchers who are working on new types of cancer therapeutics using code, basically. So if you are somebody who took the messenger RNA vaccine, so that would be BioNTech or Moderna, that very same, those vaccines were actually in progress for the past many, many years. Researchers were trying to figure out new ways to treat cancer. So there, we've got all different types of therapeutics on the horizon, you know, different ways to brew beer. I've got a bottle of whiskey that was created that's pretty good, and it tastes like it was barrel-aged, that was made in a San Francisco lab rather than a distillery in Kentucky. So I think we're looking at things like that.
What was it made with?
Well, it was made with molecules. You know, it's interesting if you're somebody who, George, do you drink whiskey or bourbon?
I'll sip a little Jack Daniels once in a blue moon.
Right. So
Sinatra, you know, told us that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's very challenging to make a, you know, full-bodied bourbon or whiskey, because there are a lot of variables outside of the distiller's control. I mean, they try to do what they can, but, you know, the flavor depends on the oak that's in the barrel, that's used for the barrel, or whatever material they're using, the humidity, the temperature. There's a lot. And basically what this process does is it reduces the amount of uncertainty. It speeds up the process of making the beverage. And, you know, it's not like the greatest whiskey I've ever had in my life, but it works. But they're also working on different types of beers. And basically you could program yeast by tweaking their genetic makeup to have different flavor profiles. There's also some work being done on adding functions to beer. So, you know, in the future, you could imagine a beer that, you know, has different nutritional properties, or maybe doesn't make you feel as full, or has brand new flavor profiles we've just never seen before.
Amy, will synthetic biology do away with disease?
Not entirely. So our living organisms are, especially complex ones, are pretty challenging to manipulate, to understand, to control.
So I don't think we're looking at a future where all disease is mitigated or eliminated. I do think what we are looking at are, again, new options for us to help treat health. And I can give you a couple of examples.
All right, hold on. We're hitting a break right now. We'll do it when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie back with Amy Webb. We're talking about her work, The Genesis Machine. Amy, right before the break, we were talking about synthetic biology, ridding the planet of disease. Not quite going to happen, is it?
No. It will at some point start to eradicate disease for sure. In fact, there are messenger RNA vaccines. And again, this is the technology that is in the Moderna and BioNTech vaccines. There's messenger RNA vaccines in progress now for the flu, for malaria, and for many years they were being studied, messenger RNA, for as a treatment for cancer. So I think we are definitely going to see new therapeutics and new treatments that give us better options to deal with some of the pathogens that exist and that we know of. There's also a whole bunch of viruses and a whole bunch of pathogens that, thank goodness, we haven't even come into contact with. Another really interesting application of this is aging. Synthetic biology is probably going to make aging kind of a treatable problem. There are some researchers who are working on pretty interesting therapies that are related to cellular decay. And what they're trying to do is reverse obesity, tackle diabetes, while also improving your kidney function, your heart function. And so far, the technique that they're using is already working in mice.
What will synthetic biology do for organ replacements? Will they create different organs?
So, yeah, this is another really interesting area. There's something called a body on a chip. So imagine, if you will, a translucent, almost like piece of plastic, something the size of a stick of gum, an old stick of gum. And, researchers are able to create what are called organoids. These are tiny, sometimes microscopic blobs of tissue that function the same as the tissue that's inside of your body. So they can make like tiny circulatory systems or tiny reproductive systems. Or tiny respiratory systems, tiny lung cells, heart cells, and vascular cells to connect them. And what this does is give us the ability to test toxins or therapeutics in a really safe way to see how it impacts our body without having to do those trials on animals or people. So that's like a tiny organ. But even in the past couple of weeks, there have been some terrific successes in growing, for example, hearts and inside of pigs.
That's right.
Humans' organs are remarkably similar to the organs that grow inside of pigs. And again, this gives us some more options than we would have had previously.
Amy, what is fueling this science? What's pushing it?
Well, I think a couple of things. This is a relatively new area of science, but it's been in progress now for a couple of decades. The human genome was just the first draft of it was finished in the early 2000s, and it was announced that it's mostly complete as of last year. So we've really come a long way in the past two decades. And now that we kind of have the source code to human life, it's giving us the ability to start to do something with it. So I think that's part of what's fueling all of the interest. Obviously, this pandemic has shifted where investors are putting their money and where some of the scientific community is doing its research.
Yeah.
So I think you've got this flood of capital, you've got heightened awareness of what this technology can do, and we have real existential threats on the horizon. We've got climate change we have to deal with and extreme weather events. We're going to have to figure out where to get our food. So a lot of what's being researched now is to help make us more resilient as we continue to live on the planet.
Instead of eating that steak, we'll be eating some kind of synthetic cardboard or something, won't we?
All right. So listen, you and I, you're from Detroit, right?
Yeah, I sure am.
Okay. So I'm from outside of Chicago.
And my family, part of my family was in Niles. So I think you and I are sort of grew up in a similar region where if I went home and told people, hey, we should get our steak out of a lab versus from a farm, I think
not going to happen. They'd gag themselves.
Totally. Right. Okay. Especially or dairy here. This is even better. Now, to be fair, on the other side of the lake in Wisconsin, they care a little bit more, I think, about cheese. But we just had the Super Bowl and Americans ate, I think, something around 1.4 billion chicken wings. That is incredibly resource intensive to grow that many chickens.
Oh, my God.
To get them ready. And, you know, it's not necessarily the greatest thing for a chicken, not the most humane, but everybody wants the wings. Well, what if instead of using all the resources it takes to grow live chickens, instead we started with a stem cell from a chicken and we created meat in a bioreactor, which I know, again, sounds like there's no way. You're right. My relatives are going to be like, you want me to do what? But it uses the same amino acids to nourish those cells as they grow. There's no hormones, no antibiotics. And within a couple of weeks, you get tissue that tastes just like a chicken wing that you would have gotten from a chicken that clucked, has the same texture, maybe the same consistency, but was created just in a different way. I think that is a terrific option. It's potentially healthier meat. It's potentially better meat. I mean, let's face it, commercial chickens don't taste that great because they're grown rapidly. And at some point, we'll be able to scale this and make it much cheaper. And at that point, if you can get cheaper meat local to where you grew up, there's no hormones, there's no antibiotics, then I think that becomes a pretty viable option.
Could we not create a chicken with 20 wings instead of two?
That is an awesome question. I think we probably could do that, except that I think that would be probably more challenging than just growing the cellular-based meat that we could grow in a bioreactor. But I totally get I get the skepticism.
They've made billions of dollars on the COVID vaccines, Big Pharma has. Would they support this kind of movement of the, you know, synthetic biology, or would they be put out of business?
You know, that's a great question. I think this ecosystem on the business side is just starting to develop. So some of the funders and some of the companies that are interested in this research are those big companies. In part because they've got the money to do the research. I mean, one of the problems that we have in the United States is that our government has not been funding basic research in science and technology for decades. And we're pretty far behind other big economies around the world in our approach to funding and definitely our approach to long-term planning. So that doesn't leave us a lot of options. The money's got to come from somewhere if we want to stay competitive and if we want to benefit from, you know, what's on the horizon. I think that it's possible that the, you know, if there's a lot of success, especially in therapeutics, that starts to erode and possibly even break the business models of some of these companies. But I also know that they were on a long-term horizon, so there's time to plan and figure things out.
Are there companies that specialize in synthetic biology, Amy?
There sure are. And I think it's important to note that there's the products, like the synthetic chicken wings, for example, and then there's the process, which is the infrastructure, the tools, basically all the things that you need in order to make the ecosystem work. So just as a quick example, there's a company in China called BGI, and they are one of the largest companies in the world for genome sequencing. So this is basically figuring out what the code is for a particular genome. Now, in the year 2006, to get a high-quality draft of a human genome, it cost $14 million. And a finished, really good sequence might cost between $20 and $25 million. Just a couple of years ago, the cost for a finished sequence dropped down to just $4,000, and today, BGI can sequence a genome for $100, which is basically, jeez, you know, less than the price of a pair of Nike Air Jordans. So there are companies that do sequencing. There are companies that do what's called synthesis, which is taking all that genetic code and putting it together. There are companies in the United States that are phenomenal, Twist Bioscience and Ginkgo Bioworks. And then there's the companies that are making products. So Eat Just is a company that is making synthetic meat. There are companies that are making synthetic, this is kind of crazy, synthetic cheese. So it's still got the same code as any other cheese, but it has no, it didn't require a cow to make it, which again is, you know, kind of crazy if you think about it.
What's the downside to some of this, Amy? What's the dark part of this?
So listen, I know I'm painting kind of a rosy picture here, and I believe that there is a rosy picture to be had, but there are significant risks. In the book, we identify 9 risks, and I can highlight a few here.
Sure.
First of all, there's something called gain-of-function research. So this is where scientists intentionally mutate viruses, or they try to make something sort of as bad as it can be. And they do this within the confines of a lab, and it's supposed to be in a controlled environment. And that's, I think, for the purpose of planning, or at least that's what we've been told. And I don't see that there's a big, there's a reason to do that in the year 2022 when we've got predictive analytics systems and AI that can help us run simulations. In 2011, there was a researcher in Rotterdam that announced that he had augmented the H5N1 bird flu virus so that it could be transmitted from birds to humans and then between people as a new deadly strain of the flu. Jeez. Now, pre-COVID, it's kind of hard to remember this, but pre-COVID, H5N1 was actually the worst virus to hit our planet since the Spanish flu. It had a super high mortality rate. So this scientist in Rotterdam literally told his fellow researchers that he'd mutated the hell, his words, out of H5N1 to see what it could do in the name of predicting mutations and developing cures. But that's really stupid. We don't need to do that type of work, and it really should not be done. So that's a big risk, and synthetic biology enables that. Turns out DNA is a security risk. In the future, you know, some of the worst security breaches could actually involve DNA. You can scrape somebody's genetic code, sequence it, and then, you know, create a targeted virus for one person. Wow. And a virus doesn't have to be deadly to be debilitating, right? You could create a virus that might give a CEO chronic diarrhea.
Or paralyze him or something.
Or exactly, right? And that would obviously be horrible for the CEO, but this could potentially, you know, really destroy the financial markets temporarily, things like that, not to mention the company.
Well, I'm convinced, okay, COVID-19 was made in that Wuhan lab. I mean,
that is something that a lot of people have been wondering. And I will tell you this.
I said that in December of 2019, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you were a little, you know, you're probably early in thinking that through. I completely understand where that sentiment comes from. And I think, unfortunately, we're probably never going to know if it was the result of research or gain of function research or something that appeared naturally. And that's because, as we all know, the government of China locked out the outside world and just
I wonder why.
Yeah. So at this point, yeah, I mean, I think at this point, like, again, there's just no reason to be doing gain of function research. But it shouldn't stop us from investing in and researching synthetic biology, which is going to provide us, you know, but we got to do this with guardrails. And that one other, I think, quick, important risk, and that's that we have different regulatory structures. So in the U.S., there's been kind of a back and forth, depending on who was in office at the time, of what to fund and whether or not to use stem cells and things like that. And, you know, it's really unfortunate, but in the U.S., science and politics are unfortunately intertwined. And that has really put us behind other countries, notably China, which has a very different approach to regulation. Biology doesn't care about regulations. You know, biology tends to self-sustain. So we're going to have to come up with guardrails, restrictions, and rules that we can enforce and that are consistent all around the world. And I think we're not quite there yet, and that is a risk.
Somebody's going to abuse this.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. I think that what does not keep me up at night, and times when I'm not up for the show, what doesn't keep me up at night is that at the moment, this is not really a do-it-yourself technology. You need to have quite a bit of knowledge. So I think this is not the kind of thing where a teenager can inject malware into the code for life.
Right.
But that's today. Things may be different in a couple of years. So yeah, we absolutely need to start really thinking through how to protect ourselves.
Amy, we're going to take a quick break and come back for a final hour of phone calls with you in just a moment. The name of the book, The Genesis Machine. It is fantastic and it's scary at the same time. Amy Webb with us, and we will be back in a moment with your calls on Coast to Coast AM.